Progressive voice of Minnesota here on FYI Politics with Brett Johnson. It is a Friday afternoon. As a heads up, today's show is pre-recorded, but do have a couple of very informative interviews lined up for you on the show today. Coming up, we are going to be speaking with Ian Millhiser of Vox. Now, the reason why we're speaking with Ian is that he is a court expert following all sorts of cases, especially through the Supreme Court. And we're going to talk to him about how chokeholds by police officers largely have no consequences for the police officers, even though in lots of cases, chokeholds have been banned by police departments. We're going to talk about the Supreme Court history behind that, that dates all the way back to the 70s and the 80s from a case in Los Angeles. So that'll be coming up in just a little bit. Also, we are going to revisit an interview I did back in October of 2019 with Kim Milliard of Minneapolis for a Better Police Contract. Now, the reason, of course, we're revisiting this is that last year, prior to the Minneapolis Police Union negotiating a new contract with the city, there was this citizen group that was put together that read through the entire prior police contract and made several recommendations which would have been beneficial not only to the police, but more importantly, to the citizens of Minneapolis. But first, I want to talk about this idea of police reform. We sometimes hear people talk about how, in the wake of what's happened with George Floyd and Minneapolis, that we need police reform. But is that really the answer? Does it go far enough? Because if you look at the history of Minneapolis, and specifically the police department in Minneapolis, we were supposed to be a shining beacon of police reform. And, well, look at the results that that's produced. So lots of people are talking about how now reform is not enough. We need something more drastic with our law enforcement. Now, Minnesota News Network, who you sometimes hear do news stories on my show, recently highlighted the city of Seattle, who tried to undertake their own police reform effort. And for the most part, it didn't really succeed very much. And I think there's some lessons we could learn from what happened in Seattle to what we need to do in Minnesota and how reform does not necessarily go far enough. Here's Mike Moen of Minnesota News Connection.
Minnesota officials have launched a civil rights investigation into the entire Minneapolis Police Department following the killing of George Floyd. It coincides with calls for reform, but watchdogs elsewhere say changing police culture is very difficult. Other recent high-profile incidents have prompted reforms within MPD, but skeptics say what happened to Floyd shows not much has changed. Harriet Walden, with the group Mothers for Police Accountability in Seattle, was involved in reform efforts when that city's police department came under federal scrutiny. She says there was a lot of optimism at first, but the problems persist.
The Seattle police enforcement still had disparities along racial lines. That was 2019. People of color were more likely to be frisked than white people and more likely to have weapons put in their face, even though those people didn't have weapons on them.
Walden is referring to the Seattle department's own disparity review from last year. And she says broader discussions about the nation's history of discrimination need to find a platform within police agencies. Meanwhile, Minnesota's Human Rights Commissioner vows the investigation will lead to meaningful action, not just a report. Walden thinks negotiations with police unions have played a role in slowing reform efforts across the country, and that leaders at City Hall need to be held accountable as well.
The city's job is to get the best thing for the city and to hold the line. And in my opinion, sometimes the cities don't always do that.
In Minneapolis, the city's powerful police union leader, Bob Kroll, has been criticized for fostering cultural issues within the rank and file. In response to the George Floyd aftermath, Kroll issued a letter to union members blasting city and police leadership over the protests and blaming the violence on a, quote, terrorist movement. Sam Sanchez is an organizer with the Twin Cities activist group calling for an even more dramatic overhaul of the department by amending the city charter to have a community panel run the force.
These would be elected officials from the community that would be in charge of all aspects of the police department, up to picking the chief to you know, the budget to the rule book.
Sanchez says this would remove conflicts of interest by no longer having officers hold their own colleagues accountable. Mike Bowen, Minnesota News Connection.
And in fact, here in Minneapolis, there are even members of the city council who are talking about the idea of either defunding or abolishing the police. That's something I want to talk much more about next week, as in fact, I want to talk to a couple of city councilors who are floating that idea. But coming up next, though, we're going to be speaking with Ian Millhiser of Vox, as we're going to be talking about the history of the Supreme Court and police chokeholds. That's on the way next on FYI Politics. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. You're on FYI Politics with Brett Johnson. We're joined now by Ian Millhiser. He is a senior correspondent and Supreme Court expert for Vox. You can follow him at iMillhiser and also find his writings over at Vox.com. Ian, good to have you back on the show. We have a number of topics to talk about in regards to some of these cases that have to do with police brutality, and specifically the case with George Floyd and Derek Chauvin. So, Ian, thanks for joining us again.
It's good to be here. Thank you.
Absolutely. So I want to start off with this case you were talking about that took place in the 1970s, because for the most part, this is kind of the case the Supreme Court ruled on that, well, allowed police to use chokeholds. So a little background on this. This took place back in 1976 in Los Angeles, where a black man by the name of Adolf Lyons was pulled over for a broken taillight. Basically, as you can imagine with what's happened with a lot of people, the officers came up to his car with guns drawn. He was eventually thrown into a chokehold, and he eventually ended up challenging what happened in the court system. But as you can talk about more, Ian, the lawsuit was kind of interesting because he was not only seeking monetary damages and criminal charges against the cops that put him in this chokehold, but he was also, it looks like, trying to seek an injunction against chokeholds that could be used by the police in the future. Can you talk a little bit about this case with Lyons?
Sure. So what happened in the Lyons case is Lyons was one of many, many people in Los Angeles who had been put in a chokehold by police. I mean, like, there were hundreds of incidents of this. The city, I believe, had an official policy that allowed chokeholds to be used even when the officer's life wasn't in danger. So these chokeholds were very common. And Lyons didn't want to just get compensated for what happened for him. He wanted to stop that practice. And what the Supreme Court said, I believe this was in 1982 that the Supreme Court handed this decision down, is they said that in order to get an injunction, in order to get a court order preventing police from using a chokehold in the future, the plaintiff doesn't just have to show that they've been subjected to a chokehold in the past. They have to show that they are likely to be put in a chokehold by cops in the future. And that's very hard to show. I mean, like, there's a serious problem of police violence in this country, but fortunately it's not so common that any individual person is likely to be put in a chokehold in the future. And so that meant that his case for an injunction died. And it meant that we could not get court orders preventing cops from using this method of restraining people. You know, I don't know what would have happened with George Floyd if there had been an injunction against the Minneapolis police. I do know that in New York, you might remember that there was a high-profile case of a person being choked in New York, and he was one of more than 200 people who have been put in a chokehold. So it's possible that one of those that there could have been an injunction in New York and that could have saved some lives. But because the Supreme Court has made it so hard to get court orders preventing police from using brutal tactics, it means that a lot of these tactics have proliferated.
And I want to go back to this ruling, which I believe you said, yeah, it took place, I think, in like 1982 or 1983. What was the What was the logic behind this in the courts? Because as far as I remember, this was kind of before we had a lot of the extreme right-wing judges on the court that would probably be a little bit more friendly towards the police. I believe it was a close 5-4 decision, but it just seems like this absurd standard to try to prove that, well, A, you're going to be choked in the future by the police, and then you need to also prove that, well, everyone else that the police interacts with is also going to be choked.
Right. Yeah, no, it's an extraordinarily high bar. I mean, it's such a high bar that, you know, it's basically unmeetable. So what I would say is, you know, the courts that we have now are much more conservative generally than the courts that existed in the 70s and the 80s. But judicial conservatism looked very different back then. So, like, now I think that, you know, the judges we have, you know, people like Neil Gorsuch, are very anti-government. And that means that, you know, they want to shut down environmental regulations. They want to shut down health laws. They want to get rid of Obamacare. But it also means that they have less of a knee-jerk pro-police reaction. In the 70s and 80s, I mean, you go back and look at what Nixon was saying about the courts, and judicial conservatives were extraordinarily concerned with letting the police do what the police want to do. And so one explanation for why the Lyons case came down at that point is that the courts were dominated not just by Republican appointees, but by Republican appointees who came up in this environment that was very concerned with law and order. Now, that said, you know, the court could have overruled Lyons at any point, and it has not. So it's not like the courts that we have now are bringing about a sea change that's trying to prevent police violence. But I think that part of the reason why you had that decision come down when it did is because in the wake of Nixon's appointees and some of Reagan's appointees, the courts took a very deferential approach to law enforcement.
So if I'm understanding this correctly, injunctions can be a really powerful tool to, well, stop actions that the police could take that would hurt other people. You brought up a lot of other high-profile incidents. Of course, we recently have George Floyd. You can also look back from a few years ago to Eric Garner. And as I think about this, the New York Police Department, in the case of Eric Garner, had banned chokeholds, even though they had had several hundred complaints about police putting possible suspects in chokeholds. So even though the police department has this rule saying that you can't do chokeholds, there's largely no recourse in the courts since you can't have an injunction. Is that kind of correct?
I mean, it's more or less correct.
So it's like almost like the police department, it's up to them to actually enforce this rule that they put in place, not the courts.
Right. So, yeah, the ordinary remedy, like, you know, if a cop does something illegal to me, I can sue for damages. So, like, I can get compensation if I have hospital bills. I could potentially make the city pay for my hospital bills. But, I mean, you know, cities have big budgets, and my hospital bills probably aren't big enough that it's really going to put the hurt on the city and make them change their policy. The value of an injunction is once an injunction is in place, if the cops continue to violate the injunction, they're, you know, potentially they can be held in criminal contempt. Judges can issue escalating fines, so they can say, okay, we're just going to fine you more and more and more until you stop. And so the advantage of an injunction is it allows the courts to put such a to impose such severe consequences on lawbreakers that eventually those lawbreakers have to stop. And so, you know, if you look at the Eric Garner case, you know, that was the case I was referring to earlier, where Eric Garner, I think, was one of more than 200 people who were put in a chokehold in New York. And part of the reason that continued is because New York City wasn't really feeling the pain from that. I mean, maybe there were some lawsuits that prevailed here and there, but there wasn't serious financial damage being done to New York because these cops were violating the policy. If there was an injunction in place, New York could have been fined, you know, millions, billions, whatever it took to get the cops to stop. And that would have been a strong incentive for the city to crack down on those cops in a way that didn't happen.
Now, of course, people can still sue police departments and individual officers, which we'll get to in just a second, for civil damages. But even when you try to sue for civil damages, you still face a number of significant barriers, like as you wrote about in your piece in Vox, where there's this thing called qualified immunity, which does protect police officers from having to pay for violating the legal rights of another person unless the police officer violates, quote, clearly established statutory or constitutional rights of which a reasonable person would have known, unquote. So can you talk a little bit more about this idea of qualified immunity, how even if you do win monetary damages, they're tough to actually personally go after the officers for?
Right. So most government officials are entitled to qualified immunity. And like the problem with cops is that cops have guns. And so, like, cops have the ability to inflict permanent harm on someone, and yet they enjoy this very deferential amount of immunity from the courts. And so, in theory, what qualified immunity means is that if you're a government official and you break the law and it's unclear whether what you're doing is illegal, you shouldn't be surprised by the fact that this thing that you might have thought was legal turns out to be illegal, and then you wind up getting sued for a lot of money because of that. In practice, the way it works, though, is that unless a court has said that the exact same thing that you did is absolutely forbidden, often cops get off scot-free. So, like, there's a recent case, for example, I believe this is out of Idaho, where police believe that a woman's ex-boyfriend was in the woman's home. They approached the woman and said, hey, we think your ex-boyfriend's in there. He has a felony warrant. Do you mind if we go into your home and apprehend your ex-boyfriend? And she said, okay, she nodded her head and she gave the cop the key. So she gave the cop permission to use the key to go into the home and find this ex-boyfriend. What the police actually did is they called in a SWAT team. They broke a bunch of her windows. They fired tear gas in at such velocity that there are big holes in her walls and her ceiling. And then they so saturated the home with tear gas that she wasn't able to live in it for 2 months because there was so much tear gas saturating all of her furniture. That was not what she gave them permission to do. And yet a court said that she can't sue the cops because of qualified immunity, because there isn't a case specifically saying that if you give police permission to enter your home, that you haven't given them permission to fill the home up with tear gas.
I'm sitting here listening to this, but that is, and this is legal in the court system. I'm just, my mind is kind of blown by this idea that she... Wow.
Yeah, and I mean, like, I'd say this case is currently pending in front of the Supreme Court. It's possible that the Supreme Court will reverse it. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, it was a Clinton-appointed judge who wrote the decision. I mean, this wasn't some, like, law and order, like, you know, authoritarian. This is, you know, there are just lots of cases where the courts have said, I'm sorry, like, qualified immunity is really powerful and it really protects cops. And, you know, even good judges look at those precedents and sometimes say, yeah, I'm bound by this.
Well, and even if you are able to bring a civil lawsuit against police, you even write about how, for the most part, recovering damages is kind of limited because, well, for the most part, you're only going to get money that will cover your hospital bills or lost wages and things like that. And for the most part, courts have been pretty reluctant to issue punitive damages, which is something that potentially could change the behavior of police departments, because if there's punitive damages, that of course hits a city or a state budget. Can you talk about that part a little bit?
Yeah. So the difference between what are called compensatory damages and punitive damages. So, like I said, most of the time when you sue, what you win is you win, like, you know, if you have a hospital bill, you're compensated for that. If you lose work, you know, you basically get back the amount of money that you lost because of the thing that was done to you. Punitive damages are, if someone does something really egregious to you, sometimes you can get punitive damages, which is just extra money whose purpose is to say, oh, yeah, like, you know, no one should ever do that. So we are going to, we are going to make you pay more to discourage you from doing it again. But the Supreme Court has put limits on punitive damages awards. The other thing that's happened, this is an even bigger problem, is that most jurisdictions have what are called indemnity laws, which means that if a cop breaks the law, the cop doesn't pay for it. The city or the state will typically pay for it. So the cop can go out and, you know, kneel on someone's neck, and you can win a lawsuit because this cop kneeled on your neck, and the cop isn't going to pay a dime. The city's going to pay, is going to pay for it. So what incentive does the cop have to change their behavior if they're not out any money?
Yeah, and that would make sense. And if you're limited in punitive damages, too, it does kind of get rid of the incentive for the department to necessarily right. change their behavior as well.
Right. That's exactly right.
And final question for you, because we obviously have conflicting autopsy reports with George Floyd, where in the original one that was filed, they were talking about how he may have had some prior medical conditions. But as you write about in your piece in Vox, you say that even those medical conditions, if he had any, shouldn't prevent prosecutors from obtaining a conviction. Can you explain why in that scenario?
Sure. So here's a comparison. Like, let's say that I want to murder a deadly allergy to shellfish. So I invite them over for a dinner party, and I secretly put shredded lobster meat in their salad. If they eat it and they have a fatal reaction to that lobster, it's not a defense that I could say, well, I didn't kill them. It was their lobster allergy that killed them. The fact that they have an underlying medical condition doesn't excuse me for murder. And, you know, so the same rule should apply here. Like, if, in fact, George Floyd had an underlying medical condition and that contributed to his death, it's still the case that Derek Chauvin, you know, committed a crime, you know, appears to have committed a criminal act, and that criminal act appears to have led to George Floyd's death. And it was the sort of criminal act that, like, you know, I mean, Chauvin had to have known that there was a risk that this would result. So, you know, I don't really think that there's a defense. Like, the way that there could be a defense is if coincidentally it turned out that George Floyd just happened to be having a fatal heart attack at the exact moment when this occurred, and it was truly a coincidence, and, you know, what the officers did had nothing to do with his death, then there could be a defense there. But the fact that he has an underlying medical condition that, when combined with another person's criminal act, led to his death shouldn't be a defense.
Well, I would at least hope so, but you never know with what we see in court proceedings involving police officers, but hopefully you're most certainly right on that. Hey, we've been speaking with Ian Millhiser. He is a senior correspondent and some Supreme Court expert for Vox, and overall just a good legal expert to have on the show. So, Ian, we can follow along with your work over at Vox.com. Also, make sure you give Ian a follow on Twitter, iMillhiser. Ian, appreciate the time as always. Good to have you back on the airwaves, even though the circumstances aren't the best. Dude, appreciate your insight into some of these legal proceedings.
All right. Thank you so much for having me.
And coming up next, we're going to be talking about the Minneapolis Police Union contract. It's an interview I did back in October of 2019, but still very relevant as to what's happening today. That's on the way next on FYI Politics. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It's FYI Politics with Brett Johnson on a Friday afternoon. So right now, we are going to revisit an interview I did back in October of 2019 with Kim Milliard of Minneapolis for a Better Police Contract. Now, the reason why we're doing this and revisiting this interview is that back in October, there was this citizen group that was put together that basically read through the entire Minneapolis Police Union contract, since at that point in late 2019, the union was set to negotiate a new contract with the city. Now, the citizen group made a number of very common sense recommendations that not only would have made things safer for the police, but more importantly, safer for the public. Unfortunately, many of these recommendations never ended up getting enacted. So let's go ahead and revisit this conversation from last fall.
We're joined now by Kim Milliard. She is with Minneapolis for a Better Police Contract, a citizen group that is advocating for some changes that they'd like to see the city of Minneapolis and also the police union make. So, Kim, thanks so much for joining us on the program today.
Thanks so much for having me.
So what sparked your group to go and look through the current Minneapolis Police Union contract and realize that changes need to be made?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so over the years, as different people have been calling for accountability for the city of Minneapolis to the mayor and the city council to take greater accountability for misconduct in the police department, time and time again, what we were hearing back from them was, well, really our hands are tied because the police union contract prohibits us from really doing anything about it. And so ultimately, this initiative and this work that we've done was a direct response to a specific excuse that we continued to hear from the city council.
So how did you go about crafting some of these proposals and changes? We'll talk about some of the individual proposals in just a minute, but how did you go about crafting these? Did you have a kind of a working group set up or?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, go ahead. Yeah, talk
so
about
it was pretty organic the way it all came out. I am part of the Racial Justice Network, and so we had discussed this kind of on our own, like, hey, the police contract is coming up for expiration. We should take a look at it and see if there's things in there that we could advocate for changes on. And then I began reading through the contract, and I began speaking just privately one-on-one with Michelle Gross, who is with Communities United Against Police Brutality. And then through that conversation that she and I had, we ended up inviting the community out for a forum to discuss the contract, to talk about what was in it. At that point, Racial Justice Network had already gone through and read through the entire contract. We had a few working group sessions on our own to just kind of jot down questions that we had or things that we read that were concerning or that just needed a little bit more research for us to understand the implications for community safety. And then Racial Justice Network joined up with Communities United Against Police Brutality and people from several other organizations. And then this summer we began holding working groups to go through, and we read through the contract section by section, line by line. And we dug into it. And then we had an attorney who was working with us who is not a contract attorney per se, but does have a lot of contract experience in her career. And so, yeah, it was all very organic.
And I think it's important to bring up is that it's not just one person who is briefly skimming the police contract and saying, hey, it seems like these things need to be changed. As you were talking about, there were a lot of people involved in this whole process. Mm-hmm. And as you said, even some legal experts as well. So a lot of thought actually went into these proposals.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and also along the way, having to look up some of the Minnesota statutes, because there's state statutes that govern some of the things that are in the contract. And so we realized that on the city level, we're not going to be able to get those things changed. And so that was another part of what we had to go through, was understanding what pieces the state statutes speak to that are kind of untouchable by the city council, and then which pieces the council actually has some control over in terms of advocating for on the front end, and then their veto power, you know, once it comes to a vote.
So let's talk about some of the specific changes that your group has highlighted. And this one jumped out at me immediately, and this has to do with officer fatigue, because it strikes mm-hmm. me as being kind of crazy that officers have, for the most part, been able to work more than 50 hours per week. And to me, that's just mind-boggling, being a police officer who, well, for the most part, has life and death in their hands. They're working in very stressful situations. And I don't mm-hmm. know about you, but I would not want to be pulled over by a cop or having an interaction with a police officer who's working their 60th or 70th hour this week mm-hmm. and is largely tired. They're fatigued, probably not in the best of mood, because at least for me, if I've worked 50 or 60 hours, I'm not exactly going to be the mentally sharpest person or the happiest person. So, yeah, that's insane that they largely are able mm-hmm. to work over 50 hours.
Well, what's really interesting that you bring that up is that when Officer Mohammed Noor had his interaction with Justine Damon, which, as we know, tragically turned fatal. He had worked a full off-duty shift the day before coming in for his night police shift. And so he was already exhausted from that, and then he starts a police shift after having already worked in a full off-duty shift elsewhere. You know, and not only was there the tragic loss of life, which is bad enough on its own, but the city of Minneapolis ended up paying out $20 million in a settlement, you know. And that's just one incident. And that's it's a high-profile one, and it's, I don't want to say it feels dramatic to bring it up because it doesn't. A person is dead. But there's so many other things where we're talking about police officers have guns and this is a safety-sensitive job. And there's plenty of other safety-sensitive jobs, I think truck driving being the most obvious one, where there's regulations on the number of hours that can be worked for safety reasons. And so, yeah, it is mind-boggling that police don't have a limit.
Oh, and that's a great point to bring up, as you talked about with truck drivers. Yeah, they largely are restricted in the terms of the number of hours they can work. Same with airline pilots, but we seem to not have these restrictions for police officers, at least here in Minnesota. So you were kind of alluding to this. Is there data showing that officers are more likely for misconduct if they work overtime? I know you brought up the high-profile example with Mohammed Noor.
Yeah, I don't have it in front of me. There was a study that I found. It was an NIJ study that essentially it got into this. It said, look, we look at the impacts of working long shifts in other industries such as truck driving or airline pilots or nursing, but nobody's really ever studied them with police. And what they found was that, and there's multiple studies, but I'm just referencing one. What they found is that 8 to 10 hour shifts were okay. You had by the end of that 8 hours, you still had, you know, your cognition levels or what you would want them to be, your mental acuity, your sharpness, your response time. But after you once you passed the 10-hour mark and got more towards the 12-hour mark with the shift time, you started seeing slower responses. You started seeing more mistakes. You started seeing more accidents. And so that really begs the question for me, well, why are we allowing them to work 12-hour shifts then? So that's really how the 50 number came about, was let's say most people work 5 days a week. Let's limit it to 10 hours. It's not a hard, like the 50 hours was what we put in the recommendations because we knew the city council would say, if you want something changed, tell us exactly what you want to recommend. The 50 hours was, I don't want to say it was arbitrary because, like I said, it was based on these studies. 55 would be okay, but I think as soon as the closer you get to 60, the less safe people are.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's true.
So that's why we recommended 50. But, you know, we're not dogmatic about that.
Right.
If negotiations come back and say, hey, let's make it 55 or 58, we're fine with that. The main thing is that there needs to be a limit.
Oh, absolutely. And even talking about any industry, it doesn't matter if you're a police officer or someone sitting behind a desk, your performance is going to go down the longer hours you work, and you're going to end up being more irritable, not in a great mood. So, and especially that's more dangerous when you're in a life and death situation, which often police officers are. Have you looked at other states or cities? Do they have caps in terms of the number of hours that their police officers are allowed to work?
We haven't seeing those. We looked at different cities' police contracts at different points along the way. I don't know that we found that there's caps on the number of hours, but I could be mistaken there.
Sure. So let's move on to some other proposed changes that you made. Again, we're speaking with Kim Milliard. She is with Minneapolis for a Better Police Contract, a citizen group that is recommending changes in the next police union negotiations with the city of Minneapolis. So another aspect that you'd like to see change is mandatory mental health screenings. Can you talk about what the policy is now and what you'd like to see changed?
So currently, as the policy is, the mental health screenings are taking place when a police officer is coming out of the academy, and so he's being hired as, we would say, a rookie police officer. They take place at that point and then after critical incidents. And those are the only two provisions in the contract where the mental health screenings need to be done. And I don't know if a lot of people realize this. I don't know what the exact rate is, but the suicide rate for police officers is pretty high compared to other industries. And we've heard Chief Arredondo talking about, you know, his concerns about the mental health of his officers, and this ties very closely into the fatigue factor too, right? Because if you're overworked, if you're tired all the time, if you have any proclivity towards mental unwellness, that's it's all going to come together. And so what we want is for the mental health screenings to be more frequent, and we're saying, hey, why should we wait until somebody's had a critical incident, essentially shot somebody, or, you know, had a lot of been on the receiving end or caused great physical harm to somebody else in order to have another screening? Why don't we be proactive rather than reactive? Let's have them every 3 years. Again, the 3 years was we looked for information. Like, we want to be as data-driven as possible and go with best practices. There isn't as much research into some of these things as we would like, but we said, well, 3 years seems reasonable. Some people want that to be more frequent. Some people would say it can be less frequent. But that's just our recommendation to have them every 3 years. And then also, when an officer is coming into the Minneapolis Police Department from some other department, whether it's San Diego or Duluth, you know, we're not sure what they're screening and other standards and practices are. So we're saying when they come in from another department, let's just get them screened. And, you know, that does two things. Number one, I think it helps ensure more protection for the public. But number two, if there is something that an officer needs help working through or a health concern that needs to be addressed, then it gives them an opportunity to take care of that.
Another issue I want to talk with you about is this idea of flexible staffing, because right now you say that 70% of officers can basically choose their own assignments, and you're saying that can kind of hurt some of the needs of the department and the city. Can you talk a little bit about that and what you'd like to see changed?
Yeah. So one thing that I think has been pretty present in the news stories recently is some of the, they would call it an uptick in crime in the downtown precinct. And compared to previous years, our crime rates are still low. And so I think some of that's a bit sensationalized. But on the one hand, we're told, hey, we don't have enough cops in the city of Minneapolis. We need to hire more officers. But what most people don't realize is that there are 11 open positions in the downtown first precinct that nobody is bidding for. And so what we're saying is that the chief and the mayor should be allowed to have more flexibility to determine what the needs of the city are and be able to move people around a little bit more than they are now. We're not saying that officers shouldn't be able to make any choices, but right now with 70% of the assignments being up for bid by the officers, it skews it more towards the officers. So we're saying let's bring some balance to that and let's let the chief of police and the mayor decide where the needs are, and that's where that 50% came from.
Of course, you have lots of other changes that have been proposed. Can you tell people where they can find a full list of all the changes that you're recommending and also highlight any others that we haven't talked about thus far?
Yeah, the website where people can read everything more thoroughly is MPLS4, that's the word for, F-O-R, abetterpolicecontract.org. We also have a Facebook page of the same name. This is kind of an odd thing, and most people, I think, aren't going to geek out to it the way that I do. But the very first thing that we bring up is city charter compliance, and there are actual several places all throughout the contract where what is in the contract does not comport with the city charter. The city charter says that the mayor has authority over certain things, and the contract gives that to the police chief. So that's in direct conflict with the city charter. And so just to kind of give people a sense of how asleep at the wheel past city councils have been and not really reading it, not really having a good handle on it before they just rubber stamp it and send it through, you know, that should be a pretty non-controversial thing to have changed. But that just kind of gives people a sense of, you know, there's things in here that, frankly, aren't even legally up to snuff.
Oh, absolutely, and highly recommend going and checking out the changes because, as you said, yeah, some of these seem like pretty common sense, very non-controversial changes to make. We're speaking with Kim Milliard. She is with Minneapolis for a Better Police Contract. So, Kim, just a few more questions for you. And
yeah.
I'd like to ask you, have you gotten any response from the city of Minneapolis or police officers themselves or the union in terms of what they think about these changes that you've proposed?
We haven't spoken to the police or the union about that. We kind of view it as we're coming at this from the side of the community and speaking with our representatives, who are the city council members. So we trust that they'll take that on and that they'll have those conversations with the union. But what we've seen, I mean, Bob Kroll said to the Star Tribune that he was willing to talk about any suggestions that are made, and whether that's a sincere, yeah, I'm really interested in what they have to say, or it's more of a, I'll listen as people say them to me and then say, no, I'm not interested. And then I can honestly say we've talked about it. I'm not sure how to interpret that.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't heard anything negative from them. Other press sources have reached out and I haven't heard anything negative. And in fact, most of the response that we've gotten from the city council has been pretty positive. So
I think it's important, again, to point out that these changes aren't anti-police measures, for lack of a better term, because they're good for all stakeholders,
not.
Whether it's the citizens, the police officers themselves, or the city. Explain more.
Well, I was just going to say one thing about that is that people are like, you know, you're so anti-cop. Well, no, we didn't go after anything such as pay, vacation time, benefits. We believe that the police officers who serve the city ought to be compensated fairly for their work and for their, you know, training and expertise and the things that they bring. So we're not trying to take anything away from them. We're simply just trying to make things safer for everybody involved.
So one final question for you. Have any other cities done something similar as you guys in terms of having a citizens group that's recommending changes to police contracts, or are you guys kind of little revolutionary and kind of being the first city to do this?
I want to say I believe that the city of Austin, Texas did something similar. I'm not sure how successful they were. I know that in the very early stages, somebody in the group was reaching out to a group of people down in Austin, Texas, about some success that they had had. But to be honest with you, I don't remember if that was related to the police contract or if it was related to a different issue that Racial Justice Network is dealing with. I know that nationally there is a focus on police union contracts and that people are starting to kind of get into this, but I don't know how many cities have actually had a coalition come together and advocate for and be successful with getting the changes. So that's not to say that we're the first, but I don't think it's happening as often as perhaps maybe it ought to.
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely. And I think this is a total great idea. And I hope other cities do this as well. And of course, here in Minneapolis, hopefully some of your recommendations are taken into this next Minneapolis Police Union contract, because overall, this is a great idea to get citizens involved because, well, police are, of course, there to protect and serve the public. And obviously, I think citizens should have a voice in that as well. So, Kim, give us one more time places where people can get more information and follow along with what's happening.
Yep, the website is mplsforabetterpolicecontract.org, and there's a Facebook page with the same name.
Sounds good. That's Kim Milliard. She is with Minneapolis for a Better Police Contract. Kim, thanks so much for joining us on the program today. Really appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me.
Now, again, that interview was back from October of 2019, but still very relevant to what's happening today. And as I mentioned at the top of the interview, many of those recommendations that were made were not put in to the Minneapolis police contract that was negotiated late last year. That's all the time I got for my show today. Stay tuned. We got Matt McNeil coming up next on AM 950.